Okay, well, the room's full, so that's a good point to start as any other, I guess. So I'm speaking this afternoon because we didn't have a chance to find anybody else on this short a time scale. I thought what I'd talk about today is some work I've been involved in over the last year to try and investigate where we might have expected the first stars to form, or the early stars to form in the history of the universe, or where we might like to look today to find our descendants or the remnants of the population. So the first point that I'd like to make is the way I'm going to do this is by studying what is expected in what's currently the standard structure formation paradigm. And this is essentially the same paradigm that David Spergel discussed last week in his talk. This is the idea that the universe is dominated by some kind of dark matter. We don't understand what. But this dark matter interacts only by gravity with other matter, at least for the last 99% or so of the age of the universe. The initial distribution of the dark matter was some kind of Gaussian random field, perhaps created in an inflationary epoch in the early universe. And structure has grown in the last, since the universe was roughly a million years old or so, by gravitational amplification of these initial fluctuations. So what evidence do we have for this directly? The most direct evidence, of course, is the observed fluctuations in the microwave background radiation, which are consistent with a Gaussian random field. They're certainly small. We observe them on scales which are much larger than present structures, although recent experiments are extending that to smaller and smaller scales. And so now we have some evidence, at least on scales that are also observable, where nonlinear structures are observable today in the present universe. We have slightly less direct evidence in the observed structure on large scales today, in the distribution of galaxies on large scales. And that comes to us by comparing the observed galaxy distribution, the distribution of dark matter predicted in such models. Here are a set of simulations from four variants of a cold dark matter model. Three different redshifts, redshift 3, redshift 1, redshift 0. So what you see across each row here is the evolution since the universe was a quarter its present size, a half its present size, and its present size in the dark matter distribution. You can see the way these initial conditions were set up. The distribution at the end looks rather similar. In all universes, they were given the same initial phases. They're also set up in such a way that the abundance of the most massive objects, things like this, which would have to correspond to a galaxy cluster, are the same at the end. And what you see is, although they may look rather similar at the end, as you go back in time, the differences become much larger. And that's because in a low-density universe, there's been relatively little growth of structure since a redshift of 3, the top and bottom cases. In a high-density universe, much more. So if you set things up so they look the same today, then they look very different at high redshift. So the evidence for this kind of picture comes then from detailed comparisons of the statistical properties of structure in this kind of dark matter distribution with the galaxy distributions, the sort of things we heard about yesterday from John Hakra. And it's clear there's a lot of qualitative similarity. You get the same kind of large voids. You see the same kind of wall structures surrounding them. You see clusters at intersections of filaments. So qualitatively, you can find most of the same features. A detailed comparison, of course, is more complicated, not least because this is the dark matter and what we see are the galaxies. So this is at least a standard paradigm. So what I want to address then is, if this paradigm were correct, where would we predict the stars to form, the early stars, and where shall we see them today? So I'm going to address this through detailed numerical simulations. Since we have a well-defined model, we can actually simulate it in considerable detail to investigate at least the model, what the model predicts. And I'm going to show simulations, mostly work done in collaboration with Volker Springel. He talked a bit about it in our lunch earlier this week. And I'm going to look at two cases, one where you might predict the first stars to be on large scales, on the scales of galaxy clusters and greater. And secondly, where you might expect the first stars or the remnants of the first stars to be in our own Milky Way. Of course, the reason for focusing on the Milky Way is we have much better evidence about the stellar populations in the Milky Way and in our immediate neighbors than we do, say, in galaxy clusters. But as you'll see, comparing the two cases is also interesting. So the conclusions at the end, these are my conclusions, some of the introduction as well. As far as the Milky Way is concerned, the standard picture of how at least the older population of the Milky Way builds up resembles neither of the classical pictures. These acronyms astronomers will recognize and nobody else will. ELS was a classic paper written by Egan, Lindenbell, and Sandage in the 60s, which was the first to explore in detail a model where our galaxy formed by collapse of a single large object. And they explained how you might understand the different populations in such a collapse. And in particular, the oldest stars form while the object is collapsing and still have orbits which reflect that initial collapse. Sol and Zinn here, this one was a paper in the 70s, which predicted that the older population of the galaxy may have come from accretion of smaller objects which were then disrupted. And most people working in galactic structure for a long time have focused on a contrast between these two versions, cartoon versions. What I want to show you is that if you actually look at what's predicted in the kind of standard paradigm now in more detail, it actually has elements of both, but doesn't really resemble either. In particular, end up having rather little relationship between the age predicted for stars and what their metallicity is. These are my conclusions. You'll see at the end how it comes about. You can get low metallicity stars, which are generally thought to be the youngest because there's then very little chemical preprocessing, can actually be quite young in this kind of picture. You find many of the older stars actually have high metallicities, so you can build up the high metallicity in a very short time scale compared to cosmological time scales, and so you end up predicting there should be plenty of old high metallicity stars if you look in the right place. High metallicity means high abundances of iron, carbon, nitrogen, magnesium, and so on. You find that the stars which we see in the halo are predicted to form before the halo itself was assembled. So that's like the Sol and Zinn picture. And in particular, you find that the oldest stars of this halo population are actually predicted to lie near the center, not at large radii. Whereas the low metallicity stars, the ones with the least heavy elements, are tended to be predicted to be predominantly at large radii. So already the fact that these two things can occur together shows you that there can't be a very strong relation between age and metallicity. And finally, if you ask where the bulk of the spheroidal population in the bulge should have come from, it's predicted to be made in a relatively small number of progenitor objects. That's to say, and you know, rough idea that 80% of the stars may be made in half a dozen objects. Should show relatively little spatial structure, at least in the inner regions, but may show a lot of structure if you look in detail at the kinematics of the stars, how they're distributed in velocity. And these are often talked about as streams, stellar streams. You find a whole lot of stars in the same region of space all moving in the same direction.
What do you mean by
I don't think... There's no clear differentiation in this. I mean, I'm imagining a model where the bulge is actually made up in the same way as this from fragments. There are other possible formation mechanisms. For example, it could be a secondary object made from a disk. In reality, I'm sure both formation paths actually occur. But the one I'm addressing here is where it's the older population, and then it's essentially just the central part of the spheroidal population. It's not different. I think that's correct for the inner bulge, particularly the high rotation suggests that in our own galaxy it may be a secondary object that formed from an instability in the early disk, for example. I think in M31 you would have a harder time making such a case. So, I mean, you know, these are complicated objects, and it's very likely that in fact there are more than one formation path possible, and different objects will be predominantly from different paths. Yeah. You hope you end up with fewer classes than objects, but I'm not sure we're there yet. If I have time at the end, I may show you some more theoretical work describing how these streams arise and showing that we may in fact have detected such streams in the solar neighborhood which show directly the results of a disrupted object. But I might not get there. So let's imagine you have a simulation of what the dark matter is doing. It's a relatively high resolution. In fact, in similar simulations which have been carried out, you can easily resolve objects with whose dark matter masses are much smaller than the expected dark matter mass of our own galaxy. Things that might correspond, for example, to the dark matter you would imagine were associated with something like the Magellanic Clouds. And so, since the dark matter is the dominant component, you can run a simulation where you believe the distribution predicted for the dark matter down to scales, non-linear scales, corresponding to relatively small galaxies. And the question is, given that, can you then make some kind of prediction for what kind of galaxies should be associated with these dark condensations? And to do that, unfortunately, needs a lot more physics. And so the parts that we have, well, we have our standard model, our cold dark matter model, whatever it is, that tells us what the primordial initial conditions are. And that's what we want to evolve forwards. The dark matter evolution we can follow down to the scales we need by direct simulation. What do we do about the rest? Well, the first part is just to follow what happens to the diffuse baryonic component while it's still diffuse. And that actually, in principle, we can simulate. You can also, to a fairly good approximation, treat it without simulation and still get the right answer, because the amount of gas that's associated with the dark matter lump to lowest order is just proportional to the mass of the dark matter lump. And then the question is, what fraction of that effectively makes it into stars? And that's what determines the luminosity of the galaxy inside it. What determines the fraction which turns into stars is not so much the gas dynamics while it's diffuse. It turns out that, in principle, if nothing else intervened, most of the gas in most objects would be able to cool off and turn into stars. What kills you is this box, is how it makes stars and what happens when the stars form, because that's a lot of very nonlinear astrophysics which we don't understand. So we know that stars do form, and we know stars have an influence on their environment through their radiative properties. They ionize the gas. Through hydrodynamic effects, they set off explosions and winds which push the gas around. And also they pollute it with heavy elements, which changes its characteristics, that changes its cooling characteristics, of course, are detectable and are responsible for enriching the later stellar populations. So this is the part which you can't treat by simulation or any other way rigorously, and so you end up having to fall back on relatively simple models with plausible, physically plausible efficiencies, but not much more. And then we know a relatively large amount about star evolution, so if you once you form stars, you can predict relatively well how they should age, and so what their observable properties should be. So you put all this stuff together, and then you hope to predict all the observables out at the other end, the abundance of galaxies as a function of luminosity, their types, their morphologies and sizes, their colors and their heavy element contents. Of course, you know, you're trying to effectively do a simulation, so you predict their star formation histories, where they're distributed in redshift. And if you have a numerical simulation, you also know where they are, so you can predict their spatial distributions. So if you try to carry out such a program, here's something which sort of illustrates the kind of recipe which you might assume, which is it's written in a very crude way, because it's very crude recipes. So making fancy plots doesn't really help. So what you get from the simulation is where there are lumps of dark matter, and as time progresses from top to bottom, the simulation tells you how the lumps of dark matter come together to make bigger lumps of dark matter. So that part you can deal with relatively well. What happens to the gas that's cooling off inside each of the dark lumps? What's going to be assumed in the models I'm showing you is that it essentially cools off and contracts to the center until it becomes centrally fugally supported. Then it makes a disk, and the disk starts making stars. So that's the assumption. Then what happens when three things come together to make one is you end up with one lump of dark matter, which now has three disks in it, one which came from each object. The assumption then is that the gas can only continue to collapse onto the central objects, and the others are just small objects, just end up as satellites going round and round inside it. So what happens then is, for example, in this case, these two may merge with each other. The two stellar disks are then assumed to form a mess. This is what we call an elliptical galaxy, a technical term for it. If more gas cools onto your mess, then your elliptical galaxy gets a disk on top of it, and then you end up with a spiral with a bulge. And then you can see...
I have trouble with that. That the angular momentum of the disk and the bulge are nearly always aligned, except in rare cases, and fact that it was a widespread phenomenon to make an elliptical, which is a small ball, and to build it later, this would not be so. And in addition, there is a lot of connection between the age and abundance of the dinner disc and the bulges. Not, that is a weaker argument because it depends on the topography. It hasn't been that well established, but it's showing up quite a bit. I say the angular momentum argument, I say, how do you beat that argument? How do you build a disc later?
That's an interesting argument. But you see, what this disc is made by the gas which cools off in this halo, right? So okay, so obviously this orientation depends on the angle, overall angular momentum of the gas, which at this stage is still diffuse. Mm-hmm. So it has some angular momentum, which is reflecting presumably the overall angular momentum of this whole dark matter distribution. Where did the angular momentum of this bulge come from? It was the angular momentum of the orbit of these two things. So to get a correlation, you need the angular momentum of this orbit of these two galaxies to be correlated with the overall angular momentum of this dark matter distribution. But where did this orbit come from? It's from these two things coming together. Where did this dark matter distribution get its angular momentum? It's also from the merger of these two lumps. So a priori, it's not obvious, and you actually have to do a more detailed simulation to see it, if the degree of correlation is enough or not.
But that bulge is going to fly on the oblate bulges, whereas the most luminous ellipticals, which
right, but most of the ellipticals which have the same luminosity as the bulges rotate like the bulges.
Yeah, but so you're just saying that things that are low luminosity made from mergers will tend to be oblate rotators, and therefore you don't need a different formation.
If they form by a merger of two objects like this, then yes. If you have something in the middle of the cluster which is formed by a merger of many objects, then probably no. But again, this is something which we don't actually have to argue about qualitatively. For the dark matter part, you can simulate it in enough detail to see. So you just have to do the simulation and look. And this may or may not be a problem, but you can address it.
What objects are the progenitors of what objects merge and then fold?
Well, I'll show you that. That's for the rest of the talk.
Are there disks like that today?
No, they shouldn't be today because they didn't merge today. They merged at redshift 2. So they should look like the disks at redshift 2, not like the disks today. And the disks at redshift 2 are much more compact. A much higher surface brightness than the disk today, so there's no problem. Yeah, but they grow. If they survive, they get bigger. So they would, by today, they'll have created all this small gas, and they've grown enormously in size.
But there's nothing in the same central phase space.
We don't know if that's true at redshift 2. When do you think the merger occurred to make N32? That doesn't matter. The later accretion makes the disk, extends the disk. It's not true it doesn't lower the phase center. It can, because you get stochastic acceleration of the stars in the disk, which is why the disks get thicker, and that lowers their phase space density. Sure, but the center is still there and undergoes the normal dynamical processes. So as we know, disks get thicker with time. We can observe it in the disk of our own galaxy. No, it's claimed that if you compare at the same luminosity, they're quite similar.
No, that's right. There's above a certain luminosity, things do look like merger products, and below that, there seems to be polarization.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's...
There are even bulges, well, you know, trying to talk about the collision of bulges, you know, not all bulges will be formed this way. Some of them probably are, but there are bulges that lie above you as they locate the line. Mm-hmm. Probably, you know, the boxy bulges.
Yeah, those are the best candidates for the, yeah. Sure. I'm just setting this up. I mean, we're arguing a higher level of detail than, you know, it's actually intended. This is just to give you an idea of what's it. Some of these things, though, we can address, like what happens when you merge spirals. And here's a simulation. Or was this the observation? Well, I don't know. Anyway, this is a set of pictures. Two disk galaxies coming together, making tails. These are regions where stars are forming. That's why it goes blue here. And the way you tell this is a simulation is that Volcker forgot that the stars have to move. They have to move a lot faster than the galaxy. So So unless those are the quasars, he made a mistake there in the plot. All right, so if you implement these kind of recipes on simulation of this kind, you can predict where the stars form. So here's a simulation at redshift 3 where the dark matter is dark, or at least on a grayscale, and the dots now show regions where you expect more than 10 to the 9 solar masses to have formed by setting up the same set of these recipes in a plausible way. And one of the interesting things you can see is that this is actually equivalent to, from here to here, is the distance from us to the Coma cluster in John's plots that he showed us yesterday. It's a relatively large distance when you expand up the present-day universe. And yet you can see there's already very large regions with no objects in. And the ones that you do see are actually arranged in quite large structures. This is, from here to here, is the size of the local supercluster of galaxies. So even at this time, the star formation is already organized on large scales in this model, which is actually a high-density universe model in this particular case. If you keep integrating forwards, see the same structures. You just see more stars, of course. It's a redshift 2. Redshift 1. Redshift 0. You can see the dark matter evolution is quite strong. Now these low-density regions have emptied out of dark matter. But the galaxies are still organized. Now there's a large cluster here into these filamentary structures surrounding the empty regions. So the pattern is actually imprinted at the beginning, even before stars form in substantial numbers. One interesting thing, which is very relevant to what I want to say later, is if you go back to these first set of stars, the ones present at redshift 3, which is about, in this case, I think roughly 10% of the final mass in stars, you can ask where you expect to see those today. Where have they gone? Since this is a simulation, you can actually follow where everything goes. That's what's shown here. So if you ask where today are the things that were formed at redshift 3, they're shown as yellow dots here. So in each of these plots, the dark matter distribution is the same. And the yellow dots are just taken from different times in the earlier set. So this is the same one as before at the present day. This is the present day location of the things which are already there at redshift 3. And you can see they're very strongly concentrated to the densest objects. You can see already that the earliest stars are predicted to be in the centers of the rich clusters and richest objects. And you'll see this more strongly in what I say later. Now, in fact, it's possible, if you want to understand individual objects, to do much better in those kinds of simulations. So here's a simulation that was used to make those last pictures. All that's been done is to use the periodic boundary conditions to the second most cluster in the middle of the picture. Right, so that's the original simulation. This is now, actually this is not the same one, this is a low density universe, but the picture looks very similar. So this is 140 megaparsecs across. The resolution with which this central object is studied corresponds to about 30 kiloparsecs. It's about the diameter, twice the diameter of our galaxy, which is, you know, a very small number compared to 140 megaparsecs, but still substantially larger than a galaxy. Now, by using a different kind of numerical approach and concentrating the computational resources just on one object, the object in the center, and reducing the amount of time you spend computing everything else, you can improve the resolution in the central region. So here's now the same calculation done with a different technique. So if you look at the structures on this scale, this is still 140 megaparsecs across, you see all the same structures. It's just what's happened is the structures in the outer region here have been simulated with much lower resolution, and all the computations we put in the center in this object has been simulated with much higher resolution. Yes. In this?
Yeah.
It's about 10 to the 9. It's measurable and believable to about 10 to the 9 times the mean. You can't see that in this plot, of course. Okay, so this is 140. If you actually blow up the central region by a factor of 20, it looks like this. So now the edge of the cluster is here. And the folk have tricked the rendering here to weight things to bring up substructures to help you see that even very close to the center of the object, there are very many bound units inside it. So what's happened? Now the resolution here, well, this is not the highest resolution. In the highest resolution case, which we have, the resolution is half a kiloparsec, 500 parsecs, which gives you a total dynamic range of the calculation, linear dynamic range, of more than five orders of magnitude, from 140 megaparsecs down to half a kiloparsec. And a mass resolution of the cube of that, about 15 orders of magnitude. So the mass resolution at the center of the highest resolution object in the dark matter is a few times 10 to the 7 solar masses. Which means that you can see individual lumps of dark matter with masses of a few times 10 to the 8 solar masses. That corresponds to a baryonic mass about that of a globular cluster, even if you form stars with 100% efficiency. So you can actually see now dark matter concentrations, and follow them in the simulation, down to masses which you think would correspond to things smaller than globular clusters. So essentially all galaxies that we know correspond to dark matter masses which are already resolved in this simulation. And what you find when you have such a high resolution simulation, so when you look inside what you think is a cluster, you actually find individual self-bound lumps of dark matter in at least the number you need to correspond to all the galaxies. And you can follow their dynamics. That's shown in this plot. You need to write software which allows you to identify those self-bound lumps of dark matter. But then here, it's just all the dense region of the cluster in one of these simulations at the end. Volker wrote software which was able to found self-bound lumps of dark matter orbiting inside this. He extracted them all. Here are the more massive ones. And this is what's left. Now it looks smooth, of course. And about 90% of the mass, dark matter mass, is here. And 10% or so is in all these lumps. And most of that 10% is in the few largest lumps, actually. Now, by running such simulations of the same cluster with ever-increasing resolution, you can do convergence tests to make sure your numerics are stable. So what he's done here, although this is plot needs updating, but we've only got the lowest three. There's a sequence of four simulations of increasing mass. So the four different colors here, there's blue triangles, blue diamonds, green triangles, red squares, and the highest resolution one's not actually on this plot. So another factor of six better resolution. What he's done is identified the self-bound units inside the halo and then just count them. And so this is the differential count, how many objects are there orbiting inside the cluster, self-bound units, as a function of their mass. This is for the lowest resolution simulation comes to here. The next lowest resolution simulation comes to here. Next lowest is here. The highest resolution one continues this trend, lies exactly along here, and goes to about there. The limit here corresponds to something which is only made of 10 dark matter particles. So you see, even counting down to just 10 dark matter particles of things, at least statistically, you get about the right number of objects. So you have a very good convergence to counting how many things there should be there. Where do these things come from? They're the remnants of all the different pieces that fell together to make the cluster. Here's another plot that he shows. He showed this also. This is the cluster at the present day with its mass represented by one red dot. These are just previous outputs of the simulation, going back in time, stepping back. You can see we kept a lot of outputs. Each previous output, you find all the dark matter lumps, and then you check which lumps fall together to make the big one at the end. It's just a bookkeeping exercise. And this plot contains every lump back to the beginning, which had at least a thousandth of the final mass, 10 to the minus 3 of the final mass. So this is a rich cluster. This is anything with more than 10 to the 12 solar masses is counted. And you can see how these things gradually merge together to make the final object. So what you find when you look in detail is that all those little lumps which you see orbiting within the clusters are the central regions of all these different things which fell in. And by doing your bookkeeping carefully enough, you can actually find which lump, little object at the end came from which object. So you can follow the whole history, down to the resolution needed to see the formation of a globular cluster inside the coma cluster, if this model is correct. So let's implement these galaxy formation recipes. Now, I told you there are things which are basically extremely crude, particularly the way you treat the star formation, the way the star formation influences the gas, and so on. So what you have to do is you have simple parameterized models for these things, which you really don't have a lot of confidence in, but they seem plausible, and then you set your parameters somehow. So normally what you do is you fix on some property of the present-day galaxy population, and you adjust your parameters till that's fitted. So what we did in this particular simulation was adjust these recipes to fit for the objects which are outside the cluster, is to fit so that the luminosity of the object in a halo of given mass was proportional to the characteristic velocity of the halo in the way it's observed. This is called the Tully-Fisher relation for spiral galaxies. There's a very tight relation between how fast a disk galaxy rotates and how bright it is for spiral galaxies. So we adjusted the star formation things until the central objects in our small dark halos outside the cluster lay on this relation. That's what you see here. And you can see that by adjusting the parameters, you can get a good fit. You can get the slope to come out right. You can get a small scatter. Well, this is the observed. Well, I'm saying the observational scatter is larger than this. So you get systematic offsets in one direction. Usually, for the kinds of recipes we looked at, the slope usually comes out about right, but you get the 0 point wrong. So this does actually more or less allow, the way we were doing it, this did allow you to set the parameters more or less. We don't care about the other one. What's interesting though is once you've set your parameters using the individual isolated galaxies outside the cluster, you can see what's predicted for the galaxies inside the cluster. And there's nothing left to adjust. For everything. No. No, we have a very simple prescription which, you know, sort of 10 or 20% effects are lost in the recipe, and so there would be additional problems if you do that. So here's what's predicted, for example, if you just count the galaxies in the cluster. Now, because we follow where everything goes and do all the bookkeeping, we know for each of those little dark lumps inside the cluster how many stars it should contain, so how bright it is. So you can just count galaxies as a function of their luminosity. This is what you get in the B band. This is a fit of a standard function for use for these things called a Schechter function, which people usually fit. And what you see is something which is roughly a power law for the fainter galaxies with a relatively sharp cutoff for bright galaxies. And both the slope here, it's minus 1.2 for the people who know about these things, and the position of this cutoff are actually quite close to what's observed. And what's more, the overall vertical normalization is also quite close. So without adjusting anything, you find you've actually predicted roughly the right number of galaxies inside the cluster as a function of their luminosity. And this kind of thing, yeah?
What mark would we expect the variance to modify?
Oh, if you actually look at the individual properties of the galaxies, actually on all scales, so that's actually related to the other point about the Tully-Fisher relation. I mean, the central parts of galaxies are always dominated by the baryons, so there are problems. I mean, it worked out this way, but actually, if it had come off a factor of two wrong, we could have easily argued that the recipe we used was too crude, and we weren't worried about it. Yeah, we fit the parameters were all set from Tully-Fisher, and then we just looked at the luminosity function.
So there's no
there are no additional parameters. In particular, one thing about the dark matter is because you see the dark matter, resolved dark matter on scales down to half a kiloparsec, the mergers between objects are no longer have to be treated analytically. You just see them. So if they come together and merge, you say it's merged. If they don't merge, they don't merge. So mergers are treated directly now instead of having to be done in some way. So from that point of view, it's then interesting to compare the morphology of galaxies as a function of distance from the cluster center. So here's the fraction of galaxies which we would say are ellipticals, which in our case just means they're dominated by the bulge component, because we don't really see any detailed morphology. So this is bulge-dominated galaxies, and these, what we call S0s, are basically equal bulges and disks. What we call spirals and irregulars are where the disk dominates. And what you see is a strong trend, so near the center of the cluster, you have bulge-dominated galaxies, and at large radii, you have disk-dominated galaxies, and the actual absolute fraction is close the observations. So you get about the right number of mergers to see the right observed number of elliptical galaxies. I mean, it's not clear exactly where this boundary should be, so there's some slop in this, but it's not far off. Because I showed you All the gas that cools is assumed to form a disk. You only make a bulge when two disks merge.
Okay, so that's what we say, form disk dominated is
kind of what material. Yes. That was why I went through that. That's that bookkeeping which the differentiates. Yeah. Well, this is all within the cluster simulation, so actually we don't really know the answer to that, because this Kelly Fisher is for the immediate environment of a rich cluster, which is, because that's, you know, all there was in the simulation.
Correct.
Correct. No, we have to argue that the overall conversion of baryons into stars in our model is quite low. That's in a sense because we've normalized we've set these parameters to get things to come out right for the disks. And so we've just assumed that however it works, that's the outcome. And so then we set the parameters accordingly. So in a sense, that was part of the parameter choice. Okay, so let me now just come to enough for that. Now let's ask a question of where the first stars form. Yes, that's why there was no adjustment of the amplitude of the luminosity function.
Okay. Right.
The actual count, or if you like, the total luminosity of the cluster it comes out quite close to the observed total luminosity. So here's a sort of different kind of plot of the galaxies in the cluster. Where now the area of each circle is proportional to the luminosity of the galaxy. So this is where all the stars are at redshift zero, if you like. So now we have the whole history of the system. You can go and ask, where were they at earlier times? Well, it turns out if you go back to redshift 13, 1.5% of the stars in the clusters had formed, and we can see where they were. So if you look at the earliest 1.5%, this is their distribution at redshift 13. This is 10 megaparsecs across. You can see quite a lot of them are still in relatively large objects. Actually, you take the first 10 objects here, it's a large fraction of the total number of stars. So there's still a relatively small number of objects. And what's more, those objects are all lined up along a filamentary structure. So this is actually a projection of a cube. This is a projection of a cube, which is 10 megaparsecs on a side. So all the stars, even at redshift 13, are lined up basically on a filamentary structure going through this. So therefore, all the metal production up to that point has also been associated with these objects. Most of it actually, of course, with these most massive ones. It's also extremely coherent. So if we now go back and ask how the metal is going to be distributed at redshift 13, unless somehow you can take the metals from here and mix them all the way out to here, it's going to be very inhomogeneous. You see, the distance you have to mix them is several megaparsecs, even a redshift as high as 13. So it's not correct to think if you go back to an early enough time, the production of luminosity, the production of metals, is going to become more uniform. In these kind of models, it does not. Now we can ask, here where these stars were at redshift 13, the first 1.5%, where did they end up? Well, of course, we know where they ended up. It's in the simulation. The answer's there. They're all in the middle. Even though they're all spread out along this filament at redshift 13, by redshift 0, they're all here. I'll quantify that in a minute. Now, there's this question of how do we identify the oldest stars? Of course, in the simulation, we know, because we know when they formed. In the real universe, people have tended to use the heavy element abundance of stars to say things of the lowest heavy element abundance are the earliest. But if you actually look at chemical enrichment models for galaxies, the thing which determines the chemical abundance of a system is not actually its age as much as its potential depth, well depth. Because what happens is in a very small object, you form a few stars, and they're enough to blow the rest of the gas away. And so effectively star formation switches off very quickly, and your overall star formation efficiency is small, and you get a low metal abundance. If you have a very deep potential well, you may self as many supernovae as you like, the gas never leaves, and eventually you get a large number of stars and a large number of heavy element abundances. And this is thought to be the reason why in the local universe we see a strong relation between the masses of galaxies, the stellar masses of galaxies, and the heavy element abundance. So a plausible way to identify which will be the most metal poor stars is to ask for the stars that formed in the lowest potential well depth systems. Of course, in the simulation, we also know not only when the stars formed, but where they formed, so we know what the potential well depth of each system was. So instead of cutting the distribution by time, I can cut them by when, so the potential well depth in which the stars formed. So if you ask where are the stars that formed first, this is the distribution at the end. If you ask where are the stars that formed in the lowest potential well depth systems, that's where they are at the end. And you can see it's not at all the same distribution. And in fact, this is statistically equivalent to the overall distribution of all the stars in the cluster. I'll show you that. So this is just distance from the center of the cluster measured in kiloparsecs. So this is 10 kiloparsecs, the size of an individual galaxy. A couple of megaparsecs is actually the sort of size of the equilibrium region of the cluster, and then it's plotted on out. And this is just the total mass enclosed within spheres of that radius. So if you take all the stars, that's this purple line, you see the mass as you go outwards increases more or less linearly with radius, actually, which is well known. That's consistent with what's seen in real clusters today. If you take the stars that formed in the lowest mass or lowest escape velocity systems, that's the blue curve, it's very similar. If you take the distribution today of the stars that formed first, let's say the first 1.5%, you get this. And that's very different. They're all concentrated near the center, as you can see. Particularly if you only count out to the equilibrium boundary of the cluster, which is here. This is actually stuff outside the cluster. And so the statistics that come out is that if you just count inside the equilibrium region of the cluster, more than half of the first stars are within 100 kiloparsecs of the center at the end, which actually is about the size of the dominant galaxy in have dominant galaxies. Whereas less than 10% of all the cluster stars are in this region, and less than 10% of the low Z, low metallicity, if you identify those as the things that formed in low potential well depth systems, so close to the center. So then clearly, this should be in quotes, because this is actually the things that formed in the lowest mass objects. So, you know, what really happens to the function of metallicity depends on whether that is the correct way to make a guess at what the metallicity of the system would be. Those are individual objects. This is a cumulative plot. So if you go across a massive object, you get a jump. Don't forget, I mean, a lot of these things are actually in discrete objects, which we're calling galaxies. Let me come to the Milky Way. Now here I'm going to use a cheat. What we should do is exactly similar simulation for an object the size of the Milky Way halo. We haven't done that yet, although there's no reason why we can't, apart from getting around to it and running, spending enough computer time. But there's a claim by other people who have done these kind of simulations that if you simulate a cluster of galaxies, a big galaxy, or even a dwarf galaxy, so the claim goes, and you look at the structure of the dark matter distribution in these kinds of models, these are then simulations of these kinds of models scaled in a dimensionless way, and they all look the same. It says the way things build up to the zeroth approximation is scale-free, so the internal structure of the dark matter actually doesn't look any different. So this is essentially the kind of dark matter distribution I've just been showing you for a cluster. The claim is if you could see the Milky Way and you blew everything up by a factor of 7 in linear scale and a factor of 200 in mass, you get exactly a similar picture, which is what this particular simulation was, and so on. So rather than run a new simulation, which we should do, what I'm going to do as a shortcut is take the same simulation and just rescale it by a factor of 7 in linear scale, 7 in velocity, and 200 in mass, which means this total mass comes down to what we think would be the dark matter mass of the Milky Way halo. And then assume the whole history is the same as it was before. The scaling is just dimensional analysis. We know what the characteristic velocities inside the Milky Way are. We know the characteristic velocities inside a... It's an empirical... Well, it's from numerical simulation. I guess, do you call that empirical? Well, it's close to understandable. No, it's because you start from Gaussian cluster, from a Gaussian field, which is close to a power law. I mean, there are refinements which would lead you to expect a weak departure from scaling. So I think what we would expect, in fact, like I can show you, there is a even the people who make the claim see a weak departure from scaling, which you can see here. This is the count of the objects inside one system. And what's shown here is the characteristic velocity of the objects in terms of the characteristic velocity of the global system and the count. And there's two curves here for a simulated galaxy like our own. One solid curve for a simulated object like a rich cluster. And you can see the curves are similar, but there is actually a systematic deviation here, which is significant. But it's relatively weak. And we understand where that comes from, but I don't really want to go into it at the moment. No. You'll see. So this is to get the dark matter distribution. Now we take the same recipes, but now everything's changed, because if you change the velocities by a factor of 7, the temperatures change by a factor of 50, all the cooling properties change dramatically. And so what you predict for the galaxies after you go through all this is quite different. In fact, what you predict for the distribution of stars today in the Milky Way looks like this. This is the Milky Way disk with 95%, I think, of all the stars. These things together are the Milky Way bulge with the remaining 5% and a few little bits and pieces. So that difference just becomes because of the difference in the way the things cool once you've rescaled all the temperatures. Because the structure of evolution was identical, it's the same simulation. So you can see it makes a dramatic difference. In particular, if you count the number of objects out here as a function of their luminosity, it's quite consistent with the observed satellites of our Milky Way. Even though you look at the thing, you can find lots and lots of dark matter objects that are predicted to have negligible luminosity. Most of these, you know what the smallest things that are plotted? Well, these are stellar masses, aren't they? They're probably up to 10 to the 10 for the larger objects, I would guess. Correct.
And yet when people like Stephen Jeffrey look at Katrina, they see some tidal chaos coming along.
Well, it's you can actually estimate the tidal radius in the models, of course, because you can see the boundary of the systems. We haven't looked at that in detail, but you actually have the numerics give you that information.
Because I think that's something that you need some models.
It turns out with this thing, because you can now be scaled by a factor of 200. So the smallest mass objects, the mass of a single particle is now scaled down to only 10 to the 5 solar masses. So the smallest things you resolve now correspond to a dark matter mass of 10 to the 6 solar masses, or a baryonic mass of 0 if you try to put star formation in, because the potential well depth is so small that the first supernova blows the rest away. If you go back in time, now you can go back in time until you first form the first 0.2% of the stars which end up in the system. So the Milky Way has about 10 to the 11th solar masses of stars altogether. So 0.2% is about the first times 2 times 10 to the 8th solar masses of stars. Where are they predicted to form? Well, that happens by a redshift of about 10, according to this model. And this is where they're supposed to form. Most of them form in one big object. Then there are a couple of other relatively large objects and a few dregs. So it's not true. You have lots of little things which all have lots of stars in them. It's actually just a few objects. Where are they? Well, most of them are here, and then the others are still along this filament. Yep.
Why do you say that the lowest mass objects will be very effective at extending gas outside of their own system? So even a few supernovas in the stars that are scattered throughout there, it seems like they would be reasonably effective.
Well, this is part of the model. This is already assumed. That's why these things are small. That's why this plot looks very different from what I showed you before. It's because we scaled down the potential well depths, you need a smaller fraction of the gas to turn into stars to blow the gas away, according to the model. And so that's why now the stars are concentrated in a few objects and the other things you can barely see. I mean, once scaled, their masses are the same as they were before. It's the same simulation. Yeah.
Oh, masses are the most
massive. Well, I just did the calculation. This was... what I say is 2 times 10 to the 8 solar masses in total, roughly. This is probably half of them. So this is 10 to the 8 solar masses in stars in this main progenitor object, redshift 10.
And that's in stars. Dark matter, how deep is it? I'm trying to
dry that. Dark matter, this would be a few times 10 to the 11.
So few times...
Its potential well depth will be quite high.
And this is few times 10 to the 11 you would get the print because they're starting.
That's the point.
I am surprised to see Q times 10 to the 11 concentrations of
So that's at redshift 10. If you wait for 1% of the formed, we come down to redshift 5. Now, well, we still, two or three objects contain all of them, right? In the bulk. There's 1%, and there's up to the total of 10 to the 9 solar masses in stars, so this one must be 5 times 10 to the 8 solar masses in stars, and this one's 3 or something.
So, the final
object is the final type of disk? Oh, yeah, 95%, according to Fermionic models, the 95% of the masses in the disk are the final object. Of the stellar mass. In principle, if the globular clusters were formed this way, yes, we could. But in fact, we don't find enough of them. Actually, I mean, we have to look at this some more. Then it's the secondary thing that we haven't actually treated. So I mean, this is if globular clusters formed in by the primary collapse in the same way as an extension of what we're assuming for galaxies, then yeah, we should see them. I don't think we do, which. Although, you know, we're making a huge extrapolation. We've basically normalized our parameters for things like star formation using the properties of galaxies like the Milky Way. So to extrapolate down the formation of globular clusters, you know, there's a huge uncertainty. So you can't think confidently, but with this particular extrapolation, you wouldn't get enough. Let's ask, where are those 1% of the stars today? They're all in the middle. Same effect as before.
Well, it's a pretty impressive scale. How is that distributed? Is that one over R squared?
I'll show you. You can do the same job and ask, well, the low metallicity stars were the lowest mass objects. Where are the stars from the lowest mass objects today? They're all over the place. So now if you do the trick that I had before, so this is the first 1% of stars. This is the first 0.2% of the stars, according to the simulation. So if you take all the stars, basically they're all in the central object. So this thing's flat, you know, because we don't resolve it in the semi-analytics. We just say there's a galaxy there, so it's basically all at the center. And this thing should probably be at the center too, in which case this line would be really flat, completely flat. So, okay, essentially all the stars on this kind of plot would be in the central object. If you take the first 1% of stars by time, then you can see the boundary of the Milky Way, of the region which is sort of in equilibrium, is somewhere around here, 200 kiloparsecs or so. Basically, half of them are still in the middle, inside 10 kiloparsecs. On the other hand, if you take them by the mass of the object in which they formed, which might be the low metallicity stars, then you get this curve, which you can see is a completely different shape. And if you go to even more extreme values, the first 0.2%, then these effects are actually become more extreme, that the red curve moves up and the blue curve moves down. So if you get the numbers here, so this kind of scaling, you end up predicting 95% of all the stars in the Milky Way system are within 10 kiloparsecs. Well, that's just the Milky Way, so fine, that'll work out right. But 40% of the first 1% are within 10 kiloparsecs, and 65% of the first 0.2% are within 10 kiloparsecs. Whereas if you take the low Z stars, which I think this number refers to the 1%, then only 14% are within 10 kiloparsecs, and 85% are distributed more widely through the system. So that's the kind of picture the simple application of this theory predicts, and as I expected, I don't have time to go into the other part of the talk, so I can... No. Well, I mean, sure, I can say something about it, but I don't have any information about it. What we know is it's very small. And it's also extremely quiet. But I don't think it has anything to do with this particular model. So to come back to my conclusions, then you can see where they came from. You see very clear there's little relation between age and metallicity. If you look at the distribution in time for when the things that I was calling low metallicity, that's to say stars that form in low mass halos, what the distribution in time of their formation is actually not very different from the formation of all the stars. I didn't show that. It's somewhat older, but not much. So whereas you, of course, the first stars form first. So, but many of them have high metallicities. That's because, as Mike pointed out, you know, if you have even the first things are in a deep potential well, then you can enrich to a high metallicity. Many old stars have high metallicity. That was the point there. You can see why the halo stars form from the halo itself. They're in these separate objects, but not very many of them. Well, that's the point down here. You saw the oldest stars, the very first stars, tend to be in the center of the system. And the lowest metallicity stars are distributed at large radii. So for the cluster, that means distributed more or less like all the stars. For the Milky Way, it means outside most of the stars, because most of the stars are in the disk. So the bulk of the stellar bulge population, this subject of the caveats we discussed at the beginning, you can see it was apparently made from a relatively small number of dominant objects in the model. These other points I didn't get to, so I'll leave out. Okay.
I'm wondering how much your results are depending on the way in which you treat the feedback, because basically what is breaking the feedback, my understanding is that what is really breaking the age metallicity relationship is the feedback, because you use conscious transformation of the problem. Now, if you want to do so, basically what you have to do is to drive away the gas to supernovae. No supernovae, even among the transformation, you don't know. If the feedback is less efficient than what we think, then you have time to pour more stars into this tiny object. So I'm wondering, how is the fraction of the 1%, 1.5% of stars that you are forming in low mass objects in which you could change the feedback of the picture and get a higher or a different distribution?
Most of these effects aren't actually due to that. Most of the effects are just due to the bias effects that big things have big progenitors and small things have small progenitors, and that small things can actually form today. So it's not in this kind of cold dark matter picture, it's not true. You start off with small things and they make big things. You have big and small things over the whole period that's relevant. And that's actually the dominant effect. So the effect of efficiencies also goes in the same direction, so that's right, but it's subdominant. I think if we basically said you made all the gas into stars in all the objects, or actually you couldn't do that, because if you did that, you'd run out of gas. But if you say the efficiency was similar in all objects, you get a smaller Milky Way at the end, but you still get the overall trends. That just comes from the way you assemble the mass. And we could try that. I mean, we haven't done it, because all the other things no longer fit. But you know, as a test case to try and separate the importance of the different effects, it would be quite interesting. It's not very strong. I mean, it's actually quite weak. No. But if you look at the dark matter distribution, it's equally filamentary. I mean, this isn't a. If you just pick out the objects by dark matter mass, you get the same. It looks the same.
But isn't it true? It's like first you've got a lot of stars forming around that star because the Earth is advanced. Then wouldn't they would fill a void, surely, and they would be put one spread out and then.
No, if you just plot the distribution of all objects more massive than X, it always looks like this for almost any X. Because I mean, there will be relatively large changes, but the qualitative, I mean, so the quantitative, they'll be, I don't know exactly how big. I mean, for the cluster case, I show you luminosity functions. If you change any of the efficiencies, what happens? You'll no longer fit the luminosity function of galaxies in clusters. In fact, you know, it's still nominally slightly too steep at the faint end, but it's close to the observations. If we made a substantial difference, what would happen is your cluster luminosity function, you'd have a very large number of relatively faint galaxies and very few bright galaxies. No, we're above the cluster luminosity functions, down to minus 14. If you plot the Kober cluster, which is, I guess, measured minus 14, it's cut with the ones things with red shifts, is still slightly below our prediction. Because you know what people do, they... well, it's stood on your side, so you can see it. They plot up a luminosity function for the Kober cluster, they get something which looks like this, is quite flat, and they go fainter, and it goes like this, and they say, oh, this is the slope. You know, but we have a curve which goes like this. And the range over which they've measured this, actually, they at the last end, they still haven't quite crossed. No, it's not particularly strong.
How do you treat enriched gas? I mean, if you have a small clump and it blows out.
Well, we haven't. Yeah, we haven't done any chemical evolution here, right? All I did was show you where the stars are that formed first and where the stars are that formed in the lowest mass objects.
Any gas that rains onto the disk now can make the zero gas.
I'm not following the velocity, so I don't care. I mean, it doesn't have a label. I mean, you can, then you have to put in more assumptions about how the chemical mixing goes and so on, of exactly that kind, but we haven't implemented it.
I'm actually missing something, because there's a heavy 11 solar mass pump that's equal 13, and yet large galaxies are not supposed to be in place.
It's not. It only has 10 to the 8 solar luminosities of stars.
Yeah, but the 11 solar mass is dark matter. So. Okay, I see. So the dark matter is clustered that massively that early?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's only one of those objects in this whole region. Don't forget the total mass in this region is more than 10 to the 13. So this what most massive object has only a, I don't know, 10 to the minus 4 of the mass.
This was in the...
Well, not that we've rescaled it. It's not less obvious, right?
Okay. Is this in the rescaled simulation? I'm confused also. Yeah. That's
rescaled. With the thing. Everything I said which was trying to make a model for the Milky Way was in a rescaled simulation.
So that there was a 10 to the 11 solar mass accumulation of dark matter from which it essentially became the mass for the Milky Way by the end of the 5D.
Well, I don't know the exact number. That was basically a guess from scaling. We'd have to go and look. I don't know if it's... But it can't be very far off from that. I don't know. I mean, what I told you is where we think the stars might be. So that tells you where the total metals are produced. I mean, we have some in enriched clusters. We know that most of the metals are not in the galaxies; they're outside. Enriched clusters have the galaxies with the deepest potential wells in them, right? The ellipticals. So in the place where you see the deepest galactic potential wells, you also see that most of the metals are not in the galaxies. Now, for all galaxies out today, but the metals were produced when the stars were produced, presumably. Now, for the things which are outside clusters, we don't see most of the gas. We don't know what its metallicity is. We can't do the calculation, so I don't know. Some of the smaller halos disrupt, yeah. I mean, actually, one of the interesting things is when you scale to the Milky Way, my impression is not enough of them disrupt. So, we haven't looked at this carefully enough yet, but it looks to me as though you might predict the stellar halo of the Milky Way was entirely in little galaxies, which, of course, it's not. Most of it's in the more diffuse stars. So that could be a problem, but we haven't really looked at enough detail to be sure. Yeah, well, almost by construction, right? Because we have assumed an initial baryon fraction, which gives us the right answer overall. We normalize the star formation, so we get the right number of stars. So the rest is presumably in there. So it's not a great result. Good question.
Probably double digits.
this extreme magnitude from the scale come from? Is that stuff ever found up in smaller objects?
No, we would have to argue that was bound up in smaller objects, and so this question of whether the thing's actually really disrupting the simulation is an important one, which we so far haven't thought about hard enough. Yeah, well, I don't know what the correct measure of separation is, but I guess it's measured in the order of a few megaparsecs. Co-moving. Not for the clusters. By the time you scale down to the Milky Way, then you can't really say much about the larger environment. So I think with the cluster scaling is more reliable for that particular, because there you're talking about a total mass that we simulated around 10 to the 16, it's a biased region of the universe. It's the region of the universe where things happen first, because it's the one that's going to turn into a rich cluster. So all the redshifts that I quoted for that region will be high compared to the global typical values, because we picked the region that's going to make the cluster. Yeah, these were for a lambda CDM model. I don't know, we haven't done the other case. But what will happen if you do the other case? We know the morphology of how things build up is the same, very similar. But the times when things happen are different, and it all happens later. So I think we'll get rather similar results, but with the redshifts move to lower redshift. Now that we do know, because you can go back to the somewhat cruder simulations that I showed earlier, where we have done other cosmologies, and it actually turns out to be easier to make most things fit in a lambda cosmology than in, say, an Einstein de Sitter cosmology. But I'm not sure if the difference is big enough that they put a lot of weight on it. No, I wouldn't use galaxy formation to argue that there has to be a cosmological constant. Even if I did, no one would believe me, so. Okay, are we done? I think we're also done. All right. Sure. Well, the rest of the talk is published, though, so. They're both papers with Amina Helmi as first author.
I'm sorry, they're
Amina Helmi is the first author.
How is that spelled?
Helmi. Okay. And there's one in Monthly Notices. There's one in Monthly Notices this year. And a second one last year, 1999. And a second one in Nature towards the end of 1999. Yeah, the first one's Helmi and White, and the second one's Helmi, White, Dezeo, and Zhao.
Oh,
well, he didn't actually do anything, but he ended up on the paper.